Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 205, recorded for March 22nd, 2023. The Cloud Pod decides to bard or not to bard. What's the question? Good evening, Jonathan, Peter, and Ryan. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you. What is the question, anyway?
I don't know.
To bard or not to bard.
Barding is an interesting subject. We'll talk about it in a little bit as we get into that. But yeah, quite a bit of news this week. So let's jump into it. First of all, we had to talk about layoffs again because Peter decided that he had to predict that there'd be like 300,000 layoffs this year. And so now we have to track them. And, you know, unfortunately, he's up to 152,858 as of recording today. You know, which mostly the shocking thing was on the list today, I know is Indeed had 2,200 people laid off today, which apparently is only 15% of their workforce. Have you been to the Indeed website? Wow. How do they have more than 2,200 employees there? I don't really understand.
Oh, this is why it's happening.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways, so that's a lot of layoffs. You know, if you combine it with 2022, we are at that 312,000 layoffs in the last really 12 months or so. So layoffs continue. And of course, because layoffs are continuing, Amazon is back laying off more people. So if you remember back in November, they laid off 18,000 people. Now they're back to lay off another 9,000 people. And this time, apparently, they're affecting AWS, HR and recruiting, advertising, and the Twitch network. All employees will be notified by mid to late April. Apparently, the delay was caused by the fact that they had not finished the OP2 planning process, which for those of you who know what that is, that is their annual planning cycle they do every 6 months to figure out their next 6 months of roadmap. And so if your team has not completed OP2 and you work at Amazon, you might want to be concerned because there may be layoffs coming for you still too, because he did not qualify this and say this is the only teams that hadn't finished OP2 in November. But he did call out this area was not finished until just recently.
Either that or when you do your planning, make it really important planning that they definitely cannot do without.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, your six pager better be really good.
Yeah. We're going to adopt one of the new UI frameworks in the AWS console. Yeah, maybe that's not the best plan for your OP2 this time. We're going to have an amazing reInvent announcement about something cool. Yeah, do that. Go with that
plan. It's like, wait, I got this great idea. Dark mode.
sad for those 9,000 people. Hopefully they find jobs quickly. Although based on the jobs data from the government, tech layoffs have not been a big impact. And most people sound like they're finding jobs pretty darn quick. Mm-hmm. So all those companies you couldn't hire during the pandemic are now finally getting those jobs filled, which is good. Potentially with a former Amazonian or Meta employee or something else. So not necessarily a bad situation. Moving to Amazon news this week for AWS. Amazon Linux 2023, a cloud-optimized Linux distribution with long-term support, is now available. This is the third generation of the Amazon Linux distributions. Amazon Linux 2, of course, was based on CentOS. Amazon Linux, whatever year they decided to designate, is based on Fedora. There are several pre-configured security policies that make it easy for you to implement common industry guidelines, as well as these images are optimized for the Amazon Cloud. You can also now get deterministic updates through version repositories using the new DNF update, which is apparently the successor to Yum, because APK wasn't bad enough. We had to give you another repo command line tool to remember. This capability allows you to run the same package versions across the fleet, regardless of when they were deployed, which could be an issue if you have long-running fleet members. I still haven't personally moved off of Amazon Linux 2 for the CloudPod website, also because I dislike the idea of using a Fedora-based Linux distro. But, maybe I'll think about it and not do it because DNF just makes it even worse for me.
I'm so dumb. What does DNF stand for? Do you know?
I don't know. It's a Fedora thing.
Did not finish.
Oh, I know, right? That's all I know from racing. That's all racing. I know is did not finish. I'm like, that is so interesting they chose that.
let's see if I can quickly Google the answer for that for you. It's the Dandified, DNF or Dandified Yum. And Yum, of course, is the Yellow Dog updater modified. It's apparently a new version of Yum. It's a Dandified, though, so it's DNF.
Like inside joke on inside joke? Is that what that is?
It sort of feels that way, right? Yeah. Like it's a weird thing. Apparently, apparently it was initially released in January 2012, and I am just not aware enough that this actually existed. So apparently it's now become the main default package manager as a Fedora since version 22. whenever that came out. Oh, May 2015. If I keep reading the Wikipedia article, I learn to answer all these questions that I have. So,
if you're all sitting in front of your keyboard right now,
yes,
type yum, and then type DNF. DNF is way faster to type, right? Because yum uses your right forefinger for all three of the keys, and DNF alternates between left and right hands, left, right, left. Super fast DNF. I like it.
It only helps you type faster if you have two hands. If you're a one-handed person, you've done this prejudice against them. So thank you for that.
Sorry.
Also, if you've taught yourself to type in the dark while sitting on an exercise ball at a desk that's way too tall, it doesn't work either.
What? Because you're just hunting and pecking regardless?
Yeah, no, I type really strange.
You got one hand holding yourself so you don't fall off the exercise ball. And so you're limited to one hand.
Arms bracing, yeah.
To be fair, DNF provided like backwards compatible yum commands. So even though it's been the default package manager for a long time, the yum commands still worked.
Oh, so just a quick alias in my profile?
Nowadays, when you use it, it'll say, hey, you really want to use DNF, use this command. So I guess they're kind of like teaching people slowly. But
why can't you just make this like yum 2.0 and then not change the command or give you the option to use both?
I mean, that if it's backwards compatible, that's exactly what I'll do is I'll just alias the command and be done with it.
It's not entirely backwards compatible anymore. That's nicer features for handling dependencies.
Yeah. I mean, it does sound like a nice problem. You know, and I have had that problem where you're like, yeah, I auto-scaled this cluster, but you know that node is a week later and six security updates got deployed and one of them breaks my app and now I have some web servers that are broken and some that are not. That is a, you know, so having that ability to kind of lock that in is a nice capability. So I can see the advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. And the they're using GP3 volumes instead of GP2.
Oh, that's good. GP3 volumes have been around forever.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the AWS chatbot has finally come for Teams. You can now integrate chatbot directly into Teams. This is previously only available for Chime and Slack. When using the AWS chatbot for Microsoft Teams and other chat platforms, you receive notifications from AWS services directly in your chat channel, and you can take action on your infrastructure by typing commands without having to switch to another tool. So if you'd like to reboot your server, for example, you could just give it a AWS chatbot command, and it'll do so. You can limit the chatbot to specific user permissions or to team room permissions. So it's a channel role or a user level role. And that'll allow you to basically authenticate these things using your IAM credentials. So, you know, somebody can't just hop into a room and reboot your entire cloud infrastructure, which would be a really bad use case. So that is at least considered in the chatbot capability now available for you for Teams, which I guess is admitting that Teams is taking over the world slowly but surely, which is I hate it.
Oh, I know. Like, I'm going to have to admit defeat on this one, I think. But
I'm not Slack. I'm just saying about Slack till I'm dead.
Good for you. Is it?
That's what you think now. Then, you know, your company gets bought by another company and they're like, yeah, we're not paying for Slack because it costs $1 billion and we have Teams for free with our Microsoft subscription. And then all of a sudden you're screwed and you're now using Teams.
That already happened to me and I'm still using Slack.
So now, no, what you're saying is you're using both.
I am using both. That is correct. I am using both.
See, that's almost worse, right? Because now I have to do two things that I,
I have to have an account on Slack. I have to have an account on Teams. I don't have to look at it.
Sure.
No one can make me look.
I mean, I have to look at both. So sad for me. Moving to GCP, the Chronicle Security Operations tool has gotten some new features for the SecOps team closest to you. The capabilities of the security teams depend on more quickly identify and respond to threats. And these new features allow you to do that much quicker and faster. Things like SLA visibility and configuration flexibility, parallel action execution, so you can execute remediations parallelly across multiple boxes, a cleaner, clearer case wall, because everyone wants to see all your issues on a wall, built-in entity enrichment as part of the alert ingestion flow, so you get better metadata to help you find the security problem quicker and faster, new marketplace updates, a new unified discovery management search capability, and expanded region support and integration with the cloud DLP, all now available to you directly from the Chronicle Security Operations Console, which will only cost you $1 billion to use.
Yeah, but have you used that, the unified search? Like, it's amazing.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Like, security, I'm just having that alone, that one feature is pretty nice.
Yeah, yeah, I played with Chronicle several times now, and I do really, really like Chronicle. Mm. I do not care for Security Command Center, but Chronicle, I'm all for. So yes, Chronicle's great.
Yeah, and I like a lot of the, you know, some of the functionality that was in Security Command Center being sort of moved over here, like the ability to sort of act on stuff that's in Chronicle. It's pretty nice.
I think the integration with Cloud DLP is good. It's finally not just a Mandiant product rebranded to Google. They're actually more deeply integrating it with the rest of the ecosystem, which is kind of what we need, really.
Yeah, I'm a little like the contextual awareness, you know, like it would be, I think I'd have to like kick the tires on that a little bit to really understand how I'd use it. It's definitely cool, but you know, like, I guess, you know, you're using the DLP service to do something like tokenization or masking. So I don't quite understand how it fits into the sort of security SOAR or SIM thing, but yeah.
Agreed. All right, Bard has officially opened up for you to sign up for the beta. I thought we were only going to talk about the fact that you can now sign up for it, but luckily Jonathan and I got into it this morning. And so we were able to play with it for a little while today. My first impression is it's not as good as ChatGPT. I don't know. How about you, Jonathan?
Uh-oh.
I've had some mixed success with it, honestly. I think a lot of the answers I get, I kind of feel like they're meta answers in a way. It's like I asked for a good title for the podcast, or asked for a list of things, or asked, you know, like what makes it the best pancake recipe and stuff like that. And it kind of gives you an outline of an answer. And then it tells you the answer it should have given at the end. Like, well, actually the answer is this, but it didn't actually give you the answer that you wanted. It tells you what the answer should have been kind of at a high level without going into details. I also found it refusing to answer questions, which I also asked ChatGPT around, sort of like not exactly inventing information, like correlating information from different sources. You know, whether it's like a health thing, like what are the similarities between this and this? And ChatGPT is happy to go off and either answer it as accurately as it can, or just hallucinate a bunch of crap and cite references which don't exist. And I kind of think that Google have probably put some more effort into not inventing nonsense. And so a lot of the denials are around when it thinks it's actually hallucinating a response that's not factual. So I appreciate that side of things. But yeah, I don't think it's close to ChatGPT right now.
Just looking at like the documentation around the two, like I haven't played with Bard, so I don't know firsthand, but it feels very much like the two models were built for their very different purposes. Like the ChatGPT was, you know, intended to be a chat bot, right? It's the interaction was part of it, where I feel a lot of the examples and demos I've seen of Bard are definitely, you know, self-interested by Google and, you know, adding AI to their search engine, right? A lot of the questions they use as demo examples are things that I would expect to see in a search browser. And I wonder if that is sort of like I wonder if our experience is now tainted by using ChatGPT for the last few months. And now we're like, hey, why is this thing, you know, it's not giving me the conversation that I'm used to. Like it's not really wowing me.
It's unfortunate because, you know, if they'd launched first, we would have been wowed by Bard. But now we have GPT-4 or GPT-3 writing code for us, so converting Python to something else.
Right.
I mean, it's really quite impressive. So yeah, I guess, yeah, you're probably right. The use cases are probably not the same use cases.
Yeah. I mean, I having played with ChatGPT, you know, I find ChatGPT to be much faster. Partially because you kind of see ChatGPT thinking as it responds to you, because it'll slowly scroll out the answer as it writes it out. Where Google, you know, chose to like wait till the answer is fully generated and existed before it shows it to you. So it just feels slower by nature. It may be the same speed. I didn't get a stopwatch out. You know, but like I was just, you know, doing some of the same things I did with ChatGPT the first time. I said, you know, hey, write me a story with knights and princesses and saving a princess from a dragon, right? And I got a decently story. And then I said, okay, well, now I want you to take that story and I want you to add cloud concepts to the story. And the first time it added like one mention of cloud computing. And I said, no, I said, the story needs more cloud computing in it. And then I got something that sort of reasonably, you know, makes some sense and isn't perfect, but you know, the ChatGPT example of this was much better when I did it that way. You know, I didn't do a cloud specific one, but I was doing something else where I was like, I want a story like this, and then I want to add something, and I want to, you know, I want to now make the witch scary versus happy, and you know, like, and you could see the changes happen real time, and it just was it felt more interactive. It felt more like it was a conversation with the chat bot versus the Google one, which is very much like, I feel like I'm going to a search box and I'm typing for a search and I'm hoping for a response that makes sense to me.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've had some really long conversations with ChatGPT. Conversations. Interactions. I haven't listened to you.
That's weird.
Let me rephrase that. Yeah. Hi, I'm John. I'm sad and lonely. Please don't. But yeah, I think as the discussion or the interaction progresses, you can say, you know, write this thing and then actually go back and correct that particular function you just wrote in Python to do something else or refactor it and do this. And the sort of the awareness of what it's already said and the context of what you're saying in regards to the responses it's given are fantastic. Whereas on Bard, it's kind of like, well, are you actually listening to me? Like, are you really paying attention to what you said and not just what I'm saying?
Total side note, I tried to sign up for Bard, you know, on the waiting list with my Google Workspace account.
And it wouldn't let you, right?
It wouldn't let me. Yeah.
I ran to
that
as well.
And then it totally let me with my personal account. I would have thought it would have been the opposite.
Yeah. I don't know. I was hoping also that this would give me access to like the new Clippy for Google Docs where it helped me write letters, but that is not quite enabled yet. So I'm hoping that comes next because I would like to play with that. But you know, because I did mention it that it did writing a story. I'll read one line of it to you because it's pretty cringy otherwise. The princess continued to fight evil and help people in need, and she always used the cloud server to store her data and run her applications. The cloud server made it possible for the princess to travel all over the kingdom and help people in need, and it also made it possible for her to store her data and run her applications without ever having to worry about them.
All right.
That's
pretty good. Yeah.
I like
it. It was a good attempt, but not overly successful.
I like asking them to finish Disney stories, but with sad endings. So it's like, write me an alternative ending to Aladdin. You know,
nice.
Which well, they did not live happily ever after. Yeah.
I'm going to keep playing with ChatGPT. As I think it's a little bit better. And I'll keep an eye on Bard. Like I said, I do hope to kind of see it pop into my Google Docs and maybe I can use it for show notes or different things, which would be kind of cool because we use Google Docs for all those things.
Well, the worst thing that would happen to AI, right, is if we only have one model. Yeah. There's not competitive, you know, competing theories or, you know, and innovation there. So, and, you know, who knows? I'm hoping that, I mean, Bard's been around a lot longer, I think, but, you know, hopefully it continues to advance as they open it up. Get it access to more data, maybe.
Yeah. All right. Azure is announcing GPT-4 is now available to you in the Azure OpenAI service. So if you'd like to now embed your ChatGPT into all of your apps through an API, you can now do that through the Azure OpenAI service. Customers and partners already using Azure OpenAI service can apply for access to GPT-4 and start building with OpenAI's most advanced model yet. This milestone, we are now proud to bring the world's most advanced AI models, including GPT-3.5, ChatGPT, and DALL-E-2. To Azure customers backed by the Azure AI Optimized Infrastructure Enterprise Readiness Compliance Data Security and Privacy Controls, along with many integrations with other Azure services. It looks cheap on the surface, but I'm pretty sure that if I actually knew how to calculate these out, that I would be like horrified at how expensive these things are. So for 8,000 context, for the prompts, it's 3 cents per 1,000 tokens, and for completions, it's 6 cents per 1,000 tokens. And I do believe Jonathan informed me that tokens are characters, which I'm pretty sure that adds up pretty quick.
Or words. They're words.
Or words, okay. So yeah. that's a lot of cost if you're not careful.
Is the context the size of the model that it's like?
I think
like, so you're going to get better results at a 32K context?
Yeah, so 8K was 3 cents per 1,000 for the prompts, and 32,000K context was 6 cents per 1,000 tokens. And then completions is basically double those prices.
What's interesting is that those are exactly the same prices that OpenAI is offering directly to consumers.
Oh.
So there's no direct competition right now between OpenAI and the Azure service.
Smart.
Yet.
Interesting. There was a quote here from Seth Hain, Senior Vice President of Research and Development at Epic Healthcare. Our investigation of GPT-4 has shown tremendous potential for its use in healthcare. We use it to help physicians and nurses spend less time at the keyboard and help them investigate data in more conversational, easy-to-use ways. And all I can think is WebMD for nurses in your doctor's office. And the next thing you know, they're going to be diagnosing cancer all over the place. because everything on WebMD leads to cancer within three steps.
Yeah, but I bet you once the, you know, the AI is rolled out into healthcare, it'll still, it'll take me like two less calls to actually get, you know, a doctor's referral note. So I'm happy about this.
I did see, I didn't put in the show notes, but I saw someone is working on a ChatGPT model to read doctors' handwritten notes. And I was like, when that happens, we're all screwed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nothing good could come of that evaluation of the human race. Like, this is how they write? Nah.
Yeah. Kind of like Google's working on it. So that's going to be awesome when that happens.
Have you been waiting months and months to hire your new AWS GCP or Azure architect only to have them be poached at the 11th hour by a startup with a juice bar? Initiative stalled because you're having trouble hiring? Well, I have a simple solution, Foghorn Consulting. Foghorn Consulting provides top-notch cloud engineers to the world's most innovative companies and can be burning down your DevOps and cloud backlogs as soon as next week. Foghorn's certified AWS, GCP, and Azure professionals are armed with infrastructure as code, and from day one will be designing performant, optimized cloud-native or hybrid environments that deliver on the promise of cloud. Their FogOps solution even provides on-demand cloud engineering to augment your existing teams. Visit www.foghornconsulting.com or send an email to cloudtalentnow@foghornconsulting.com and tell them the CloudPod sent you. Your dedicated FogOps team is with you for the long haul, and they bring their own juice.
All right. Well, I have a story from Oracle. And of course, it's a very negative story against other cloud providers and makes Oracle look like they're amazing, which is the classic Oracle story that I like to cover. Oracle this week is comparing Kubernetes platforms between the hyperscalers and themselves. And of course, surprise, Oracle is the best Kubernetes platform per Oracle. Oracle talks about two different types of Kubernetes managed services. Managed or cloud compute instances, and serverless, which are, of course, where the full management of the worker nodes, including configuring, upgrading, scaling, and so on, is taken care of by the vendors. So they compare the following services for your edification: EKS and EKS with Fargate, AKS virtual nodes and virtual nodes with Azure Container Instances, GKE and GKE Autopilot, and then Oracle Container Engine and Oracle Container Engine for Kubernetes virtual nodes. They break down the various costs associated with the components and warns that costs between regions and other clouds differ widely because, first of all, Oracle is standardized pricing across all regions. Keep that in mind. They did calculate out the cost formula is a combination of CPU plus memory plus boot volume plus node plus cluster costs. And in the first scenario they gave us, which is a serverless scenario, they have a single cluster with 20 pods on 20 nodes running every day for 30 days, where each serverless node is configured with 2 vCPU and 8 gigs of memory. EKS apparently was the second most expensive at $1,700 or $1,749.88. Azure was $1,741.04 and GKE was $1,848.67. So they're all somewhat in the same ballpark. And Oracle came in at $820.80, half the price.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Wow, amazing, right? And then the second scenario, they covered managed nodes. This time, 20 pods on 20 nodes running every day for 30 days with each managed node is 16 vCPU and 64 gigs of memory and 50 gigabit boot volume. EKS came in at a cool $9,022. Azure was $10,060. GKE was $7,819. And Oracle was $4,376.90. Again, half the price. They then go on to tell you that they could have saved more if they'd used about 50% more if they'd used preemptible VMs in the Oracle Cloud, which I thought was ironic because, of course, they didn't point out the fact that they didn't use spot instances or RIs or savings plans or any other savings model possible to you on any of the other cloud providers out of the box. And so all the advantages goes to Oracle in this comparison once again.
It's the next generation cloud. Isn't that what they said?
Yeah.
Isn't that what they called it?
Can't wait to get unbreakable Kubernetes.
Yeah.
So I want to know the E4 Flex instances because they're comparing that against, you know, M6G, 4X Large, things like that, which are beefy machines. And so, like, the base price per hour on demand for the E4 Flex is half. I mean, it makes sense, right? Because they said they were half the price. So what's an E4 Flex instance exactly? How does that actually compare with an M6G, 4X Large?
Well, they said they're equal in memory and CPU. They didn't say they were different.
Exactly.
Yeah, everyone's equal. Some things are more equal than others.
An E4 Flex is an AMD processor. They didn't call this out. It is an AMD processor. Let's see if I can find out the answer to this question for you.
Why is it called Flex?
I know.
It's like a flex, you know, like when they're showing off.
Yeah, so a standard E4 Flex is 64 Oracle CPUs and 64 gigs of memory, up to 1,024 gigs of maximum memory. So apparently you can add additional memory to a VM, but they did not do that. And they are built at per second granularity with 1 minute minimums. Da, 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 da. Yeah, I don't really see much here that makes me think it's shenanigans. I'm not just a weird name.
It's got to be shenanigans.
I mean, again, like, I think the fact of the matter is the list pricing for Oracle is less. They did, but like in the Google example, they didn't use sustained use discounts. They just used the rack rate. And then in EKS and AKS, they just leveraged. So like the way you leverage these different instances.
Every day for 30 days, right? Yeah. Right? You have to run on demand for the other platforms.
Correct. So even in GKE, they eliminated the sustained use discount. They didn't factor that into the process. And they also eliminated free tiers. They do call it out in the article that there is a free tier credit that they did not include in their price. But you know, there was $74 in credits from GKE and then an additional some amount of credits for AKS that were in their things. So yeah, they say they tried to make it as apples and apples as possible, but yeah. And every cloud is different architecture. And so
because you can't really negotiate the individual.
They should have just done on demand, yeah, versus on demand, right?
Yeah.
So unless they're doing the Oracle, you know, like they're saying that the very lowest negotiated price of Oracle for that compute and CPU and committed use discounts and all of that jazz, like, I think it's a fair comparison.
Well, an OCPU is actually not a dedicated core. So an OCPU is a core and it's hyperthread. So they're counting hyperthreads as independent cores.
Well, that explains half the cost.
Well, it does explain half the cost, right? Because AWS doesn't do that. A vCPU is a vCPU, not a threaded core.
Yeah. So this is why it's important to know your architecture of your cloud.
There you go.
When looking at these things, because these things matter into pricing and all kinds of scenarios. So, I mean, at this point, you know, I haven't kept up on the performance degradation of a thread, you know, a hyperthread versus a normal CPU core. Like, is it that different still? Is it still like a 20% hit between the two types of, you know, a main CPU core thread or a hyperthread?
It depends what they're doing. If they're running the same workloads, then they're sharing parts of CPU, and then one thread will be throttled and the other one won't.
Yeah.
But I think people are just moving away from that in general because of just the security risk of cross-thread kind of data leaking. Which is why none of the ARM cores are multi-threaded, hyper-threaded, sorry.
Well, that's part of the problem with like some of the SQL Server licensing is they charge you for hyper-threading versus in for threads. So like you pay, you know, basically a server that looks like 8 to the operating system, you're not paying for all 8 of those in Microsoft licensing terms, which is super annoying. Because again, it's still not a valid use case. So
yeah, it's weird because they actually recommend that you turn off hyper-threading for SQL servers simply because you can't be guaranteed that you get the same performance out of the other half of mm-hmm. the core.
Exactly.
So Oracle all the way then, huh?
Yeah.
What I know I'm wrong? Signing up right now with my credit card. No, I'm not. All right. Well, we're on to a new Cloud Journey series this week. We finished up migrations last week. We gave a great plug for Foghorn, Peter, so you weren't here for
Dr. Yay.
As we talked about all the migration tools and trying to decipher the amazing thousands of ways you can migrate to the cloud providers. And we said you could help undecipher all that mess with someone like Foghorn who uses all the tools and can tell you which ones work and which ones don't. But now we're going to talk about cloud native architecture. And so first up, what is cloud native architecture, Jonathan and Ryan and Peter?
Well, I wrote my canned answer down later because I didn't want to mess it up. So I think cloud native architecture is merely an approach to building and running applications that use cloud computing principles and technologies, things like containerization, microservices, orchestration platforms like Kubernetes. And really the goal of a cloud-native architecture, I think, is to develop scalable, resilient, portable applications that you can easily deploy and manage in a modern cloud environment.
Yeah, so the CNCF, they talk about really the building blocks of a cloud-native architecture are immutable infrastructure, microservices, declarative APIs, containers, and service meshes per the CNCF. So there are some debates about, you know, how you want to interpret this and whose mm-hmm. answer you want to give. But really, it's about taking advantage of that cloud computing, cloud nature, you know, like I just said about Oracle, you know, understanding your architecture is important. Like in Amazon, you're taking advantage of the fact that your region isolation, they have multiple AZs, taking advantage of those type of architectures natively in your application to provide a highly resilient, highly available performant application really at the end of the day.
Yeah. I usually extend my definition to include like, you know, some of the, you know, managed services like, you know, DynamoDB or, you know, any kind of like hosted key value store where, you know, the, some of the things that, you know, are cloud, you know, sort of no-nos in cloud adoption sometimes because of, you know, concerns about vendor lock-in and price gouging and that sort of thing. Like it's, you know, cause it, does seem to me a lot of cloud native gets conflated with, you know, containers or serverless and just do that. And it's like, then you're cloud native. I'm like, yeah. You know,
you're also cloud locked in.
Well, I mean, it's just, I don't, you're just as cloud locked in or not, right? Like in a lot of ways, because it's not, it's never as easy as people think.
It's weird a little bit too, because you talk about DynamoDB, for example, right? You know, it's a cloud database that I can only get on cloud. I can't run it on premise. It has, you know, capabilities that are cloud native and auto scaling and serverless and things they've added to it over time. But then like, is RDS for SQL Server cloud native then? Or is it not? Because it's based on a legacy technology that was born on-prem that doesn't support those things. So it's sort of, you know, you get into some of these kind of like weird philosophical debates around cloud native and managed services and where do managed services fit into a cloud native architecture. So like, you know, is Dynamo or Spanner the only way to do cloud native database? I don't think so, but
no,
I'm curious what your thoughts are.
No, I mean, I think if you, even if you're running your own database engine on your own compute, it still can be cloud native, right? It's more than that, but it is, you know, an understanding of leveraging technologies that are well suited, you know, for your use case. So you may run them, you may not. And so, you know, typically when, you know, when talking to developer teams about cloud native, it's really about education, right? Because a lot of development teams are very used to sort of either, you know, only being able to leverage what their infrastructure or operations teams can provide them or, you know, or just the tools that they're aware of. And so you can gain a lot of velocity if you sort of offload some of that responsibility by using a managed platform or, you know, like a workflow engine or database or, you know, any kind of, you know, sort of enablement there that you can embed into your application and functions. It's awesome because you get all of that sort of scaling built in.
Yeah, I like Jonathan's definition better than CNCF because CNCF kind of applied what I think Jonathan's approach would be given today's current technologies. And then said, this is sort of the model you should use. But I think it really comes down to the fact that the cloud, there's different capabilities in the cloud, different strengths, different weaknesses. And if you don't start from scratch and say, okay, given the capabilities the cloud has, what and which cloud you're on, right? What the platform capabilities are, I should be designing from the ground up based on that. And a lot of times that's challenging because For most of us, we're not starting with a from scratch workload. We're starting with something that's running in a data center. And so, you know, picking that up and moving it to the cloud and not building it from the ground up means you're going to leverage, you're going to get stuck with some of the weaknesses of the cloud, all the weaknesses of the cloud, but maybe not benefit from all the strengths. And so the end net plus minus might be net minus. But that approach of just saying, hey, let's look at the strengths the cloud has and the weaknesses and build something based on that tool set, you're going to end up with cloud native.
I want to plug our interview show that we did, Justin and I, with Ravi Mayuram, CTO of Couchbase, because he has something really relevant to say around, you know, around databases and NoSQL databases especially. And so I think, you know, what he would say is no SQL Server, RDS for SQL Server, it does not count as cloud native. That technology is old. It was designed for, you know, people to operate. It was designed for a small team of people with a small application. It was never designed to be like web scale consumer facing. You know, RDS SQL Server doesn't scale to tens of millions of transactions a second, whereas things like Couchbase can. And so I'd say Couchbase is cloud native because it supports the scale of that's required by internet-facing applications or games or, you know, the travel industry or anything really, whereas SQL Server wouldn't stand a chance in those situations.
Yeah, but what if your cloud native need isn't millions and millions of records and that massive scale? Cloud native does not mean that, you know, your application has to be at large. And I don't know, I think it has a little bit more to do with just building, understanding your cloud provider and using all of the tools they have to their optimum.
And that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, he's coming from a very SaaS database application perspective. And I think if you're doing B2C or you're doing B2B SaaS, I think your answer to this question is different than if you're doing, you know, you're moving your IT workloads to the cloud. And I think that's probably where you're seeing that difference. But it was still interesting to hear him walk through a bunch of his thinking on that and the move to edge. And that's a great episode that dropped last week that you should check out on the feed if you have not already.
Yeah, when we were, you know, preparing for the show, I didn't expect it to be sort of a debate on the definition of the term, you know, so much so that we're playing with Bard and trying to get its answer on what this was and doing little research points. And, you know, like it's, I have been making sort of the assumption that my definition of cloud native architecture and cloud development patterns is in line and just sort of assuming, like, you know, throwing it out as a buzzword, didn't realize that the minutia, when you look at these different sources, are very different. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it was funny because I gave you the answer Bard gave and you're like, that's terrible. That's the worst answer yet. And it was like, well, that's the answer Bard gave. And then I went.
Yeah, but then you dig and there's like nine different other answers that are, you know, like equally as different and, in my opinion, wrong.
It's like asking what's DevOps.
It is.
Yeah, it is. Oh my God, don't get me started.
No, I know. I didn't realize that this was in the same territory. It definitely is.
But I think maybe the key way to kind of think about this is not so much about what we just talked about, which are the principles of it, but really, what are the benefits of cloud native architecture? Like, what am I getting out of doing these patterns? I think that maybe is how we should tackle this problem. Because again, I think there's a lot of industry FUD out there about what cloud native is, but I think the benefits are what really drive the value.
Yeah, you maximize the benefits of the platform you're on and you minimize the weaknesses of it, or you maximize the strengths of it and you minimize the weaknesses of it when you design for that platform.
Well, I think it helps you become more agile as a business. I think it scalability is an important thing, is a huge benefit. I think reduce time to deliver a product or deliver a service that you're building. You know, we're not waiting for Dell to deliver us racks of servers anymore. So I think reduce time to market. I think better utilization of the resources that you are paying for. You know, great, you get 90% 90% utilization out of the hardware you've got RIs for. Fantastic. If you had a data center, maybe you got 50%, or maybe you have to keep a huge buffer because the lead times on new hardware is just ridiculous. But I think really improved resiliency, fault tolerance, sort of integrated management and monitoring. I think those are all real benefits of cloud native architecture.
The other thing I think is cool is that you, like, obviously cloud native architectures could be really efficient at really large scale from a workload perspective. They can also be super efficient at really small scale. I think that's something that is totally unique to cloud. Like, we do some tiny little thing where it's like, dude, I'm just going to get an S3 bucket because I need to drop a couple of these little text files in there that my Lambda function is going to read every once in a while. Who would have built an object store in their data center to do that? Nobody. Nobody would do that.
Yeah.
And it works great.
Yeah. I mean, it does really empower a very quick iteration time on innovation. Like, you know, I was able to make a small little thing on my Raspberry Pi that could identify who was standing up to the beer tap because I was utilizing, you know, Amazon recognition, right? Like I would never build a model that would be able to do that sort of image recognition if it wasn't just like an easy to adopt service that is an API call away. And so like it's, you know, you can really take advantage of those things to fit your use case. And, you know, you can, you know, create a lot of damage and spend a lot of money if you do it wrong. But, you know, if you're careful, and even when you are careful.
So like, if I interpret what you just said in terms of a business, I think what it mm-hmm. lets you do is focus on what the business needs to focus on for its core competencies and purchase services from the cloud providers for the things that you don't want to mess with.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of the advantages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I need the Raspberry Pi app for the beta test, by the way. Could you also have it like automatically bend as you approach?
I didn't get that far. I did get a flow sensor where it was going to tally up how much by person.
I don't know about that. That's like that dumb feature where my phone tells me.
You can see where I stopped, right? I'm like, oh, this doesn't, I don't think I want that data.
Yeah. Sometimes it's better just not to know. Ignorance is bliss. So as you think about, you know, adopting these things, getting these benefits, what are some of the challenges or disadvantages of cloud native architecture from your guys' perspective?
I mean, it requires huge culture change within an organization. It's probably the biggest obstacle I can think of.
It's a lot of learning.
Yeah, and then just the transformation cost of taking something that was optimized for non-cloud, and now you're like, okay, what's it going to cost to make this thing cloud native? What's the return on investment? How long am I going to have to, you know, run this thing on the cloud before I see that return? And who's got the patience for that?
I think people underestimate the changes you have to make to operate something in the cloud. There's migration of an existing workload, but even established patterns of like how we build and deploy software and how we manage it. Like, you know, you start trying to adopt a Lambda function and you realize your the way that you store and manage artifacts just really doesn't work very well for a Lambda deployment. And how the hell are you even supposed to use these Lambda versions and all these things? There's a lot of different, you know, patterns that you sort of have to drop what you know and pick up a new one. And there can be definitely a lot of ambiguous answers on the internet on what is the new pattern or the right pattern. So I think that's definitely a challenge I see a lot.
I think it also introduced a lot of complexity in places you don't expect it, because if you're moving from a monolith on-prem to the cloud, and yes, we're all going to go for microservices, we're going to break this thing down over a period of years, and now we've got 65 microservices, and how on earth do we coordinate releases across 65 microservices, or how do we coordinate communication between those microservices? Yeah. There's so many things that are difficult to deal with and often surprise people, I think. And sort of, in a way, what you're doing is moving the complexity from who used to be the people who used to have to manage that stuff mm-hmm. to a different place. And so it's a new responsibility for different people.
Yeah.
Just moving the complexity.
Well, I think you talk about trying to orchestrate the, you know, deployment of some 60 some odd microservices. I don't think moving to cloud native divorces you from doing a good 12-factor app and having, you know, loosely coupled microservices, loosely coupled, you know, understanding what the contracts are between microservices, backwards and forwards compatibility, you know, which we'll talk about 12-factor a different time. But I don't think this is a replacement for doing 12-factor. I think it's one more framework you should consider in addition to looking at 12-factor in your model. But I think there's nothing that prevents you from going to cloud if you're not cloud native. I just think you don't get the advantages of the cloud native and what the cloud brings to you. And then you get into that conversation of like, well, should I be repatriating my data to my on-prem data center? Because it's so much cheaper. And if you didn't take any advantage of anything on the cloud, then that's a hard conversation to win to not move back to on-prem. And so I think this is one of those areas where it depends on your use case. It depends on your situation, but it doesn't mean you have to do it. Just be aware of what you're trading off by not going cloud native.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times have I seen the mistake where people just adopt cloud just for the sake of adopting cloud and then realize that it doesn't really make sense and they haven't made their lives better. They've just added a whole bunch of complexity and they tried to fit a round peg in a square hole, or wait, the other way around. And so, yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's understanding the right use case for the right platform.
Agreed. Well, good. Maybe one last thing we touch on today for this week is maybe some common tools or technologies that are, you know, using cloud native, or maybe are cloud native already that you're aware of that people take advantage of that maybe you want to call out here.
I think something that I use a lot and have used a lot is either auto-scaling groups or managed instance groups. The ability to bring up clones of images to scale your application up and down in minutes is probably one of the most valuable sort of features of the compute offerings in any cloud I've found.
Mm-hmm. I'd say definitely Microsoft Silverlight. All jokes aside, I think my favorite part is the fact that now that infrastructure is an API call away, managing infrastructure as code is a game changer.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, some tooling and practices, you know, defining your environments as code, it's really impactful to be able to have a declarative sort of layout of your resources, and keeping it repeatable, keeping it where you can deploy new versions of it and you can iterate faster. There's all kinds of arguments about, you know, the CDK model and the state, you know, state management and state management of and outside of the cloud. And those aside, because there's pros and cons there, just being able to repeat environments is super, super powerful.
Yeah, I definitely agree with most of your guys' tools. You know, infrastructure's code tooling, Pulumi, Terraform, you know, the HashiCorp products around console and some of these that you get kind of built into some of these things. So they're all really great cloud native solutions built for the cloud problem. And, again, you don't have to take advantage of those tools specifically. You can take advantage of SaaS tools as well, which are also a different form of cloud native, where you're just dealing with an API and loosely coupled, hopefully at that point. So good. Well, next week, we're going to cover more as we go deep into the topic of cloud native. We'll talk about microservices and containers, those pesky things that we talk about all the time with Kubernetes, with disdain, and all the other ways.
Going to find out that we don't agree what a microservice is.
Yeah, that'll be fun. So stay tuned next week for that, and we will see you next week here in the cloud.
See you later.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.
And that is the Week in Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions. After show, let's do it. All right, so Peter had to run, but we have a quick after show here to talk about Meta's Year of Efficiency. And this came out a couple weeks ago, but we didn't have time to read it before the show, and I felt it was important. So Mark Zuckerberg, the robot that he is laying off another 10,000 Facebook employees. But he did so in the most exciting way possible by publishing his manifesto on all things efficiency. And he starts by highlighting the goals of the efficiency work that they're doing, which is 1, make Meta a better technology company. And 2, improve their financial performance in a difficult environment so they can focus on their long-term mission, which is taking over the world and eating your brains. The efficiency work has several work streams, from improving organizational efficiency, dramatically increasing developer productivity and tooling, optimized distributed work, and garbage collect unnecessary processes, and more. He did lay out a timeline for Meta employees. What they should expect is that over the next couple of months, the org leaders will announce restructuring plans focused on flattening their orgs, canceling lower priority projects, and reducing their hiring rates. With less hiring, he has decided to reduce their recruiting team, and that is the first team being laid off here in the most recent announcement. Restructuring and layoffs in the tech groups will occur in late April and then in business groups in late May. So a very nervous quarter for all you Meta employees who listen to the show. Now, to the manifesto, building a better technology company. He talks for 2 paragraphs, but the too long due to not read, is if you want to invent the future or apply the best ideas to reach people at the greatest scale, the Meta is the best place to do that. And with that in mind, he points to making Meta a stronger tech company. And he says you're going to do that in 5 ways. First is flatter is faster. manager should have a span of control of 10, and some managers will be asked to go back to individual contributor level. What do you say about that?
I mean, this is one area where I really do sort of, I agree. I think that I don't want to see any teams bigger than 10. I don't think a single manager can effectively do all of the things a good manager can do for org size, at max 10. 10's rough, right? Like coaching those individual members, making sure there's a career path for all those individual members, all the different things that, are sort of squished to the side for management. Are really the challenging part of larger teams. And I do feel like a flatter org structure is good, right? A lot of layers of bureaucracy and telephone game doesn't feel good when you're at the bottom, right? Like it's great if you're at the top because, everything's filtered up and you only get the important stuff, but you lose a lot.
Or you don't get all the bad news, which is also the problem with it.
Yeah. Well, and you lose context, right? You lose a lot of insight. Like it's a different perspective on the ground.
It's pretty good at building silos too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the challenge with 10 is that really that means your job is being a manager. And so if you're in an organization where managers are expected to do 50% code, this is not so great.
No.
But if your job is to be a manager, then a span of control of 10 and you're just doing individual development, you're doing planning, you're doing coordination, you're doing meetings, that kind of stuff, then I think that maybe makes some sense. But I think it really depends on your org. And how much development is expected of your manager versus management of your people. And again, whatever that balance is, I think will kind of fit into this number. And so if you're doing 80% coding and 20% management, then this is way too many people. But I also dread the idea of doing that many reviews at the end of the year too.
Well, you have to have, you have to leverage different roles within a team, right? You can get a flatter flatter decision tree while still, by having a tech lead or a group of tech leads, and having senior members take control and leadership positions and different things. And right. Like if you're going to flatten to this area, you have to dedicate that management. This you can't really expect.
Yeah. You're making a trade-off in developer
to be an individual contributor.
Yeah. That's why, maybe some people should go back to being IC. I think that's mm-hmm. a reasonable point that, you're a better coder than you are a manager. And so being a full-time manager would not be a great choice for you.
Okay, anytime you want to bring that up in the day job, just let me know.
Okay. All right, the second bullet point, leaner is better. Since reducing their workforce last year, Meta said that many things have gone faster. Zuck points this to be an underestimation of the indirect costs of lower priority projects. And Ryan and I are probably the biggest advocates of this of all time. Like, we hate work in progress. And, reducing the quantity of things that we're doing at one time and focusing on the things that matter is like a part of our ethos. Mm-hmm. I think at this point, we constantly talk about how do we do less? Because when you do less, you actually end up doing more. And so when you spread your team across 100 things and you have a team of 30, right? No one's getting anything done on those 100 things. But if you have a team of 30 and you do 5 things, you can get a lot of things done in those 5 and they'll get done faster than you expected. And then you can do 5 more things. And so instead of delivering none of the 100 items you were supposed to deliver, you can deliver 10 things with high quality and with high expectations. And you have a happier team who's has a better work-life balance.
I like the analogy, actually, of having a team in multiple locations, multiple time zones, multiple floors, even of a building, becoming less efficient because communication becomes less efficient between the teams. So keeping smaller local teams, it does make sense. Because if you're waiting for somebody on the other side of the world, it adds an eight-hour lag to the answer and to your potential action to take. So yeah, I can see why keeping people local who work together will be make a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a factor when you think about remote work. Keeping remote workers engaged and the chains of command and the chains of feedback and all of those things kind of broke down during pandemic early on that we all as managers had to then learn how to, be more direct in one-on-ones and have more effective one-on-one conversations, which was probably good for management in general, because I think it was an area that, the informal channels became the main channel for a lot of managers as a crutch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. Like it is, even I found I was using some of those things. And so it was nice to sort of have forcing functions.
Yeah. Keep technology the main thing is the third item. Meta is a technology company and their ultimate output is what they build for people. Everything else they do is in service of that. So this one I think is very unique to Facebook because they highly pride themselves in the engineer-led company and the being the technology company. I think this is one that I probably would agree in some organizations and probably disagree in other organizations. I think this one really depends on your org. It is still something to ask the question, though, and understand it.
Yeah, this is the part that I found the most interesting. And I don't know if that was because, you know, working for Yahoo in the 2000s when it was going through its identity crisis of whether it was a technology company or a media company, you know, like it really did matter because every time we shifted our focus, it not only was there just the cost of switching and that level of disruption, but it's, you know, when you're trying to align a workforce to achieve greater goals, it really matters, mm-hmm. you know, because it just changes the target and it changes the filter of how you evaluate which choices you make. And I think this is the right thing is being very specific for, you know, Meta as a technology company and being very declarative and not waffling on there. Cause I do really think that waffling was a terrible experience and I don't recommend that for anyone.
I'm not a great fan of Meta. And so when they say, you know, everything we do is what do they say?
Output of what they build for people.
Yes, everything else we do is in service of that. Well, I mean, that may be true. Everything they do is in service of the stuff they build for people. But those people are the investors. Those people who want returns on their money. Then they're not building things necessarily with consumers in mind. I still very much believe that the users of Facebook are the product. And
I'd like at least a head nod in that direction, you know, like, you know, something that makes it feel like a real statement rather than a puff piece, mm-hmm. you know, like, cause it is sort of like, you know, like if you don't acknowledge sort of the reality of like your situation, right? Like no one works for free. Everyone's here trying to make a buck, but you know, there's different areas of, you know, selling out that you can go through, like depending on your motivation, right? Like I've stolen Justin's line over the years of that I'm coin operated, but you know, like I also can't work if I'm not interested in doing a thing, right? Like I just can't motivate myself. I can't bother, you know, get myself out of bed in the morning. And so like those, you can have both things. You don't need to just, you know, only, you know, say that we've got the, you know, highest aspirations and we would never do anything wrong. And we're here, we're just helping out, peace and love, man. When you're, you know, really, you know, all of the news is how they're selling our data and mm-hmm. turning us into advertising dollars. And so it's just like, meh.
Yeah. And melting your brains with VR and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm.
Look how Do No Evil worked out for Google.
Yeah, exactly. These altruistic ideals don't always work out, but mm-hmm. at least be honest with yourself. All right, the next one, invest in tools to get more efficient. Meta is focused on the long term. This means investing in tools that will make us more effective over many years, not just this year, whether that's building AI tools to help engineers write better code faster, enabling us to automate workloads over time, or identifying obsolete processes that can be phased out. This one I love. Love this mm-hmm. one so much because I think this is one of those areas where investing in the process, investing in the scale of the process really becomes super important. And earlier, before the recording of today's show, we were talking about our day jobs, you know, casually as Peter, Jonathan, and I do as we go through the show notes and prep what we're going to talk about. And, you know, Peter brought up P versus PC, and that was production versus production capacity. And you've got to invest in production capacity to get production. And so, you know, just like a factory floor, you can put 1,000 sewing machines in a building and hire 1,000 sewing people, and they will sew 1,000 garments per unit of measure an hour, right? And if you want to scale that business, you have to then figure out how to do that. And so you have to invest in production capacity. And that may be, I'm going to take 500 of those sewing machines, I'm going to turn them into, you know, 6 automated machines that can do, you know, 20 garments per minute at high velocity. And that actually now produces output of the system. Now, again, in a late stage capitalist society, that means less employees, which isn't so great. But also it's the reality of how these businesses have to scale and what Wall Street cares about and how they work on these things. But that's just a pretty extreme example. But those things exist in every business. You know, a process only lasts so long before it no longer can scale. And you have to make those investments. And I think, you know, there's life cycles in a company history, from revenue to a maturity model, from being a startup to being a mid-sized company to being an enterprise. These all factor into these things. And the process that got you where you got today is not the process that'll get you to tomorrow. And so I think this one I agree with a lot.
Yeah, I like the idea of faster code builds too. And I don't think it's because that developer was sitting there waiting for this thing to test it. I think it's because while they were waiting longer, their mind wandered onto something else. Mm-hmm. And it took them longer to get back into the groove of the task at hand. So yeah. it's a lot about maintaining focus rather than not hanging around for that extra 30 seconds or 60 seconds.
Yeah. Well, it's all about maintaining developer flow, right?
Yeah.
And that flow state, and how do you keep them in flow state for as long as possible? And so, yeah, anything you can do to keep that streamlined is advantageous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, long before DevOps or, you know, continuous integration, continuous delivery, all I was doing was chasing that dopamine hit of closing this thing, right? I'm done. Check the box, right? And you want that to happen as fast as possible so that you can move on to the next thing, right? And it's, you know, like I do really, you know, I've made a career out of, you know, optimizing in this area just because I hate it so much. When you're sitting around waiting for something to complete, not contributing, not really doing anything, doesn't feel good. And so you context shift away from it and you never get back, or I never get back. It's a squirrel. And so like, this is, you know, I think it's a great investment for companies of any scale. Like I hear it a lot in smaller companies that where they're like, nah, we don't need to build a, you know, a big release thing. Cause you know, we only do this a couple times. It's easier for me to just bug Carl. Like, I don't know. I don't agree. Compile faster.
Yeah. I think about, the situation where we had a build job that required a hardware token that was attached to someone's desktop in the office. And, you know, how does that scale as you move to going remote? And guess what? It doesn't. And, you know, that now becomes a challenge that you have to solve. And like, that's just another example of, you know, the things that you did before work just fine. But as you continue to think scale and global and international employees and teams, how do you continue to enhance and build out the stuff? So again, invest in tools to get more efficient, I think is great.
Yep.
And then the last one might be a little controversial, but I sort of hear what he's saying. I like to get more data, but in-person time helps build relationships and get more done. Meta is committed to distributed work. That means they're also committed to continuously refining their model to make this work as effective as possible. Basically, in their early hypothesis and research, they believe those who joined Meta in-person then transferred to remote or remained in-person performed better on average than people who joined remotely during the pandemic. And so basically what he's saying is there is a need to create culture and to create connection that happens early in a career or early in your tenure at the company. And once you've established those models, then you can go out and be free into the world and you can be a productive Meta employee. And I think, you know, even as we have gone back to work to office, and, you know, we talked about moments that matter is one of our big themes of our back to office thing. And I'm hopefully not spilling too much internal tea, but, you know, moments that matter around, you know, like doing things like sprint planning and ceremonies around sprints and scrums and doing reviews and, you know, whiteboarding out solutions to things. And like, those are things that we said, you know, we want people in the office to do those things when it's appropriate to, if they wish to do so. And so we encourage those activities to happen in the office. And we sort of had a reasonably decent uptick and people coming to the office to do that. And I find it so much more fun to go whiteboard on the wall than to try to do it on my iPad in a Teams room, which never works the way I want it to. But I do think those connections do matter and they do have value. And I see Ryan more often now. I see Jonathan occasionally now more often, although I always saw Jonathan because he's like a mile from my house. So we see each other more often, but just not in work situations.
I think he's an AI construct. I haven't seen him in person.
I think there's some value to it. But again, this is one of those areas that it can be controversial for some who don't, you know, there's a whole camp of people who believe that, you know, there's zero reason to ever return back to an office and ever set foot in a building like that again.
I think context is key here, right? I think it's silly to say that returning in person is the only way to accomplish these things. I think that, you know, my anecdotal experience does reflect this. And I think the data, when examined on a larger scale, will back this up, right? That the effectiveness and the performance of people who hired remotely. But I would also say that's probably a shortcoming of the system. I think you have to change the way you operate if you want to do that, right? And so I think it's more of a decision of how do you take advantage? And I do think that, you know, as in the world, we're at just a turning point. We've realized the benefits of remote work. And we've made some trade-offs coming, you know, not going into the office. And I think we have to then, the pendulum swings the other way, and let's focus on the moments that matter, as much as I hate that saying, you know, and really just use it for the things, get the benefit, right? Yeah. Whiteboarding is way better than remote collaboration. Like, it just is. It's way easier to hold the conversation, the cues, the body language. You know, you're not stepping on each other, or, you know, all of those things. It's a lot easier to do. And so that's one advantage. But do you need to be in a seat Monday, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5? Nah, but don't do that.
Yeah. Makes no sense.
I agree with the sentiment of that last piece, actually. I think being somebody who onboarded remote only, I felt very much the lack of social interaction during sort of the onboarding phase and meeting people in person. Because there is something completely different about scheduling a meeting with somebody who you've never met in person and talking to them for a business purpose. Like, not having an established relationship of any kind completely changes the sort of the feel and the flow of the conversation and the dynamic of the relationship of, well, who's asking who for what? And, you know, am I your superior? Am I not your superior? I mean, do you trust me? I think it's very hard to build trust in the types of sort of episodes of communication that we have when working remotely. I think, to Ryan's point, I think it is really a reflection of the fact that we didn't quite do it right. You know, things do need to change. And I think a lot more focus should be placed on, I mean, like, happy hour is one thing, like, get the team around, have a chat, do some fun, do some team bonding things, you know, have a quiz, whatever it might be, just kind of a little, I mean, as much as work isn't a place to socialize necessarily, I mean, humans are very social animals. And I think it's a very important part of building relationships, even in a business environment. And I think, like, going back to the very beginning of COVID, you know, my son was in kindergarten remote on Zoom, and just the lack of social interaction between the children was really noticeable in their behaviors. And what they needed was a happy hour on a Friday afternoon or twice a week or something, where they could get to know each other as classmates, and then work together better sort of later on. That didn't happen at all. So I think I sort of the same thing happened when I joined remotely. It's so difficult to be introduced to new people. It's difficult to sort of gain people's trust because you just don't know who they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that I find, like, a pattern that I found that is effective that I think more people should use is, you know, it's simple, but it's like, have just an ongoing working session, like 2-3 people tops, can't be bigger than that because it's chaos, and just work side by side virtually for this time, an hour, two, whatever. It allows that natural conversation to happen. It allows the, like, oh, I can't find this thing, you know, and you're in the desk next, you know, it's a natural way of sort of recreating that. It's painful, you know, like, a lot of people don't like being on video as much, myself included. But, you know, it's again, that is one of those areas where I find that ad hoc communication is super important.
Yeah. My only other point about this, the manifesto, was that, you know, they announced the plan, they're going to restructure, they're going to lay people off. And they've also frozen hiring in the process. But once the restructuring is complete, they're going to start hiring again. Like, it seems maybe, yeah, a little.
They just said they were going to remove the freezes, right? It's not quite the same as we're going to start hiring again. It's just,
yeah, I mean, they didn't say they're going to hire 10,000 people back. They just, yeah, you know, they won't be scrutinizing it quite as heavily, I think, is basically because they'll have right sized their planning.
It seems like a great opportunity to hire people back at a significantly lower salary than they were offered previously, though.
I mean, assuming they're still on the market, which we talked about earlier.
Yeah. I think the intent is not for the people that are being laid off, but it's for the people that are remaining. It's future looking, it's forward looking. Like, this isn't going to be the beginning of just the spiral. right? This is a reset. And so I think it's more communicating that there's another side of this.
Yeah, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I know you're the only person left on this team that used to be 15 people, but don't worry, we'll hire somebody eventually.
Yeah. Beatings will continue until morale improves.
Yes, exactly. I think we've beaten this horse to death, though. So it was good good chat. But it was interesting to see his thoughts on it, even though I don't always agree with Mark Zuckerberg and his robot ways. But, it was good to know. Good to understand. So. All right, guys. Talk to you next week.
See you later.
All right. Bye.